Welcome to episode 148 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week we've got Mark Roberts, who is in the third group of Smalltalk kids who were part of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center's Smalltalk teaching experiments back at Park and at local schools in the area of Park. So it's a good podcast, interesting stuff that I didn't know about the origins of Smalltalk and the early days of how it developed. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas Smith, the lead on our Web Velocity project.
Hi.
And I also got Mark Roberts, who's in our documentation team, and he's here to talk about his experiences, I guess back in the day would be the best way to put it, at Xerox Palo Alto Research when he was one of the Small Talk kids. So, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about how that came about and what it was about?
What year are we talking here? It's wind the clock back. What year is this?
Well, we're going to go back to the early 70s.
And do we have a piece of going back in time music to that can fit into here?
We need the Wayback Machine sound. Yeah. Oh, great.
Well, now that Michael has ruined my hearing, what little was left of it. So go ahead, Mark.
So my apprenticeship with Smalltalk happened in a larger, kind of more significant story. So I think really I should start there. Because really, it started with Alan Kay and Xerox PARC. And Kay formed the Learning Research Group, LRG, at PARC in 1971. And really, the explicit goal of teaching children how to create software and the idea for a new computer language called Smalltalk first took place at that time in 1971. But during the first 2 years at PARC, no kids were actually involved yet. There were many pieces that were still missing, like hardware, software, a pedagogy, a curriculum. But all of these pretty quickly fell into place. In the fall of 1972, Kay designed the first Smalltalk language on paper, and Dan Ingalls surprised him by implementing it in BASIC on a Data General Nova. This was before the first Alto computer appeared, which happened next year, 1973, in April, and Dan pretty quickly ported Smalltalk to that. So actually, Smalltalk was the first language that was designed at PARC that ran on the Alto. And at this time, by the way, the Smalltalk group generally referred to the Alto as the interim Dynabook. That's how it was always named in the documentation, too. So this language was Smalltalk 72. Classes looked kind of like functions, but they could produce instances. There was no class inheritance. The syntax of a message was actually determined by its receiver's class. This was not fixed through the entire language. It was also a partly iconic language using rebus characters that you could type from the keyboard, and it was fully interpreted, but not using bytecodes. There was no compiler. So Smalltalk 72 had some pretty significant differences from the Smalltalk that we know today, and that really took shape later in 1976. The last missing piece in Kay's plan was somebody who could design a curriculum for teaching kids, and that would be Adele Goldberg. She was the one who really brought the pedagogical know-how to actually work with young people, and she joined LRG in 1973. So at this point...
This was kind of the fatal flaw in Alan's design here, wasn't it? That you need to teach kids how to use computers, because as time has shown, kids just teach themselves.
Well, I think they sort of figured that out over the course of a couple of years, and I'll say a little bit about that. So when they started teaching the classes, they were at Park, and this started in the spring of 1974, and the students were all invited from the Palo Alto Unified School District. And really, there were three phases. 2 years first of small classes at Park, then a semester at Jordan Middle School, and then another year back at Park. And I think in those phases kind of evolved towards less emphasis on teaching, just as you suggested. And the immediate goal was to have the kids learn object-oriented programming with an emphasis on problem-solving through creative activity. And a second broader goal was to figure out methods for manipulating information that could be grasped by non-programmers, because for Alan Kay, that was really the future, that most people using computers would be non-experts, essentially. So this kind of came from his idea that the user interface would somehow have to become a learning environment, kind of along the lines of Montessori and Bruner, and that end-user literacy would mean that emphasis had to be shifted from looking at things like data and control structures to some kind of more biological scheme of cells interacting by sending messages. So the first group of kids that came to Park included some of the youngest. They were aged 9 to 15. The second at Jordan Middle School were mostly 7th and 8th graders. And the third were all high school students. I participated in the third group when I was a freshman in high school. The first group had more kind of formal instruction with some of the LRG staff serving as tutors. I don't know if they actually had classes, but they had tutors, and the tutors were involved, though this evolved into some peer teaching experiments where the kids themselves actually acted as the tutors. And for documentation, Adele first wrote a very short guide that was called The Box Book that introduced programming concepts using the example of a box class that could do things on the screen. Basically, this was an ancestor to Class Rectangle. And by the spring of 76, there were several of these guides, as well as the Smalltalk 72 instruction manual, which was the original orange book. So that was published in the spring of 76 too. And the box book was basically for the younger kids or those who didn't have any prior background in programming, while the instruction manual was for the more advanced students. In the second phase, three altos were placed at a local public school in the Independent Study Center, and a one-semester curriculum was organized with four classes: simulation, computer graphics, geometry, and animation. And again, Park staff came and acted as tutors, but during this phase, they were not available outside of the class, and the students had to figure out more on their own. But Adele thought this was a good thing, and I think this influenced the way they approached the teaching of Smalltalk from then on, because during the third phase back at Park, there was even less structure. The emphasis was really on exploratory experience, not instruction in a kind of classroom environment. And again, that's when I came into it.
So you actually did it at Park Place?
I did it at Park, yeah.
And
Park Place was another building that they got later, but I did it at Park on Coyote Hill Road, yeah.
Did they, I mean, I know, I'm just concerned parents, did they pump you full of strange drugs?
No.
just the red pill and the blue pill were the only options here, I think.
Right, as far as I remember, yeah.
As far as you know, you might have been programmed by the Smalltalk machine, not to mention what actually happened. But
yeah, and you know, I mean, many years later, I'm still working with Smalltalk, so draw your own conclusions. So at the beginning, of course, nobody really knew how to teach object-oriented programming, and Adele came up with an approach to start by teaching students to use and then to modify and extend an existing class. And she started with really the concept of classification itself, not with syntax. That was something that was to be learned from the documentation. And she came up with some simple forms that she called design templates, which were used to help students compose classes, because that was seen as an important exercise, basically, to take a problem and then turn it into classes. And these design templates were just really a three-column table one for the name of a method, one for an English description of what it did, and one for a Smalltalk description of what it did, the Smalltalk code. So basically you started by writing out in English what you wanted to do, and then you figured out the Smalltalk code for that, started with the documentation and then wrote the code. And then this was also useful for going to talk with the tutors, because the students would have something written on paper and then they could show it to the tutors and work on trying to get the right Smalltalk for the English that they had written out. So since the emphasis in this was not really on learning control structures and such, this approach, they decided, seemed to work best with students who already had some programming experience. And also Adele observed that the kids who were age 11 and up seemed to learn the concept of classification more easily.
Well, hang on. What you say, some programming experience. Where would they learn programming for back in 72? Well, they're in the classroom. It's not like they have a personal computer at home.
Right. Well, I mean, that was still very new at that time. But some schools did have access to time-sharing machines with BASIC. My junior high school did. That's how I started with it. I started when I was 11 in the early 70s, and I had used a PDP-8 at a place in Menlo Park, and there were a couple of HP time-sharing machines in the Palo Alto School District.
It wasn't as unusual as you might think, Michael. I was in high school pretty much at the same time on the other side of the continent. I was in New York State, and we had a terminal. It was. I don't know if it was the same kind of thing you had experience with, Mark. We had a scrolling paper terminal that was tied into a mainframe in Buffalo, and the programming language they were trying to teach us, of all things, was APL.
Wow.
Yeah, so I remember it was, well, the thing is, it was in the math department, right? So the idea was that computers were like math, so APL seemed to fit their sense of how computers are going to be used in the school system there. So the computer programming language they were trying to teach us in was APL. Oddly enough, most of our time was not spent in APL. Mostly we played the Star Trek game that we found on the system.
Yeah, ours was in the math department too. They thought about it the same way. We had BASIC, which was a little less painful, I guess. I don't know
Less painful, actually. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even today, BASIC is basically the language that kids learn when they're first programming.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, so when I first visited Park and learned Smalltalk, I'd already spent about 3 years writing little games, simulations, and programs to solve the math problems that I was learning in school. But Adele often described the central activity in writing Smalltalk as modeling, so I think this really inflected her approach to teaching, and the focus was on classification and communication, not really on algorithms or control structures, subroutines, that, you know, sort of how to organize your programs, that kind of thing. So I guess when I first encountered Smalltalk, I was kind of a typical student in that respect, having a little bit of this experience. But since I entered during the third phase of their experiment, the introduction was really a lot less structured. Basically, I was just given a copy of the Orange Book, about 10 minutes of instruction on how to handle the Alto workstation, how to boot it up. From there, I had to pretty much teach myself. The Park staff were around. We could ask them questions. We did sometimes. But for us high school students, they were kind of intimidating people. So mostly I just hunkered down and learned it from the book. And this book was really an example-driven guide, a kind of a learn-by-doing approach. There were about 50 pages showing how to draw, use BitBlit, and create classes. And then finally the basic concepts were formally defined: classes, instances, message sending.
Jump in actually just to ask a simple question here. You said that some of the Park people were kind of intimidating as far as you guys were concerned. Who were these Park people that were kind of intimidating?
Well, I remember some of the main players, but there were a number of people who I don't have names attached to who were just kind of like these grown-ups there who were around. And since it wasn't a regular classroom environment, there were rules and we were allowed to just kind of go in and do what we wanted. And so it was sort of like we had to go and kind of, you know, find somebody and sort of say, here's my question. And in a way, it was easier to just kind of blunder through it ourselves.
So what year was this exactly?
Okay, so this was late 1976, early 1977. I don't remember the exact month when I went up there, but it was in that year.
Did you know kind of the significance of what you were seeing when you went to use these computers? Or was it just this is the computer and I'm using it?
Well, I had learned BASIC before, but clearly this was something really different. Smalltalk was a lot more powerful, a lot more malleable, and that was immediately apparent. There was a machine there with a lot of complexity, whereas BASIC just kind of had this sandbox, and you couldn't have any sense of what was underneath or behind it, or that you even should care about it. And Alto was of course my first encounter with a modern workstation with a GUI. At this time, as Jim said, teletype machines, ASR33s, these were the usual interface to a computer. So starting with a mouse, a windowing system, fonts, turtle graphics, this was all a really new experience, and it made a big impression.
To contrast that with what we were doing in New York, since we were working with just the teletype machines and the ASCII terminals, well, actually not even ASCII, they were all kinds of keys on it because it was able to put out all the APL symbols. Two things were going on those machines. Well, I guess three. There were the handful of people who actually were trying to learn APL. Then the rest of us were either doing ASCII art, and I'll leave it to your imagination what kinds of ASCII art that was. And then there was Star Trek, and We must have killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of trees playing Star Trek. So that'll contrast with what Mark was encountering when he saw an actual workstation with graphics.
I mean, how did you handle the mouse for the first time? What was that?
That was actually that came pretty naturally. But the first Smalltalk didn't have the kind of mouse menu window interface that we're used to now. Each window was basically a Smalltalk interpreter, so you didn't have to use the mouse as much, and there wasn't this kind of point click drag select editing paradigm yet. That came with Smalltalk 76. You know, if you wanted to edit a method, you had to type in its name on the command line, and then you got like a little structured editor, and you could move through the levels of parentheses inside a method if there were some, by picking things from a little menu. So there wasn't as much mouse interaction involved. It was more like it was a little closer to a shell experience. But the mouse seemed very natural. I guess I hadn't enough experience with the other thing, just a couple of years, to feel it was very ingrained. I mean, the funny thing is we were all very sort of thrilled by this environment and, you know, playing with turtle graphics and such. But Alan Kay later said that what he really wanted to see was that we were learning how to build interactive tools. That was one of his goals, to kind of see us evolve as a group to a sort of, so to speak, Neanderthal tool creating stage. And watching kids having fun with turtle graphics, well, Seymour Papert had done that with Logo, and so it wasn't really reaching the kind of conceptual breakthrough that Kay was looking for. The concept of classes had definitely allowed some significant early successes, but Kay and Goldberg also said that they wondered if these weren't isolated, kind of the hacker phenomenon. They knew that they had enabled the kids in some ways, but they also felt that they hadn't really found an approach that could teach them how to do design. That was another goal, that they were trying to figure out how to do that. And Kay described this using an analogy with literacy, basically the difference between learning how to read and write versus knowing a literature and being able to organize ideas. So orthography, vocabulary, and grammar versus rhetoric and critical thinking, if you will.
I mean, that's a pretty ambitious goal, right? I mean, if it were that easy to invent tools, we wouldn't have spent so many years running around, hiding in caves, hunting animals with stone, right? It's a bit ambitious to thrust an alien device in front of a kid and hope they'll invent the teleporter for you. I mean,
yeah, sure. No, I mean he didn't use the like the Neanderthal analogy. That's just, you know, I'm just saying that. But I mean, when he talks about trying to get kids to create tools. I mean, obviously that I think that's what comes to mind. So yeah, I completely agree. It was extremely ambitious. So yeah, but I think through these experiments, some insights arrived that influenced the development of the language as well. For example, they started to think about having more expert developers build frameworks that would then be used by novices, and they started thinking about using class inheritance as a way to achieve this. So Smalltalk 72 didn't have class inheritance, and I think this is one of the reasons that they added it to Smalltalk 76. So I guess after a few months at Park, I wasn't there for very long, really. I had understood the idea of classes. While things like eval were still pretty much a mystery, I spent a lot of time exploring typography, but I didn't really build any serious applications. I wasn't asked to. It was really more about playing, about exploring the environment. One of my friends, Neil Warren, he was more industrious, and he actually wrote a basic interpreter in Smalltalk and showed it to Ted Kaler, who remarked, "Ah, you've made a diamond-studded pig pen."
It's kind of the way to inspire people right there.
Yeah.
You've taken our $5,000 machine and put BASIC on it. Thank you very much.
but I mean, still, for this high school kid to have done that, you know, wow. So LRG was focused on how children learned advanced concepts, how they could be taught object-oriented programming, and then these kind of crazy, more ambitious goals, how to build software tools, how to do design. And then one of the broader goals was to try and figure out this new sort of literacy and how it might be taught. And
it's interesting you mentioned high school, right? Because I remember I got to use computers in primary school. And these were Apple IIe's, and I think we even had a Macintosh at that point. But mm-hmm. It wasn't until high school when I started learning geometry that I was able to create something that my friends and I actually enjoyed on the computer. And I made this game that was four players, everybody crowded around the one keyboard and sort of reached their arm in so that there was room. And you know, it was sort of like Snake, except that you could move in all directions and you had weapons and defenses. And it was called Line Wars because you drew lines, and if you crashed into somebody else's line, you died and they got a point. And that was pretty much the game, and it consumed many lunchtimes, people playing that. In fact, at some point there, I think there were like five computers with four kids on each playing this game that I created. But, you know, it wasn't until I'd been handed tools like geometry and understanding circles and angles and things like that that I was able to build something more interesting than a clock or hacking, you know, Hangman so that I could find the word.
Yeah, so maybe the timing with high school coincided with that as well, that all of this kind of grew out of thinking about numeric and geometric problems, and we don't really get introduced to that until high school.
Well, is it also a matter of tools? I mean, the reason I say this is that years ago I introduced some sixth graders to Smalltalk through using Squeak and eToys, because I thought it would be easier to use eToys, and most of them had not had anything like geometry, but they were able to grasp how to make things move around the screen just using the eToys interface. So I'm kind of curious how things might have been different if they had had something like eToys as kind of a way of getting, you know, kind of introducing stuff like that.
It's a big disconnect between the computer doing it for you and you understanding what it's actually doing. And that disconnect always worries me a little bit, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, with this kind of environment, I think it can minimize that disconnect to a certain extent, because you get a little simple geometric shape and you tell it to do something and it just does it on the screen in real time. And of course, it's all smoke and mirrors to make that happen, but it feels like there's less of a disconnect. And yeah, Jim, I wonder about the availability of these tools too. I mean, part of this was that at Park they had to make all of this stuff and then try and figure out how to teach it. And if they already had it and just focused on pedagogy, maybe they could have figured out, you know, how to introduce younger kids to it as well.
Right. One of the things we have to keep in mind is that they were just kind of landing on the shore, if you will, whereas the people who put together eToys, they were well inland by the time that came along, right? Whereas Xerox PARC back in the early days when you were there doing this stuff. They hadn't seen any of that. They were just learning about how to teach. They were just learning about what needed to be done, I guess.
Yeah, really, I think the only precursor was Seymour Papert's experiments with Logo and teaching children. And I don't know so much about the ages that he worked with, but as far as I know, that was the only other attempt before this to really make a concentrated effort with young people.
Mark, were you aware of what an operating system was and that the operating system at PARC was all Smalltalk and you could change it?
By high school, yeah, I had a sense of an operating system because I had also started using an HP machine, an HP 3000, which had an operating system, although we didn't really have any access to it. Now it became clear that there was kind of this like sub-basement level. And on the Smalltalk machine, there was an Alto operating system, which we never really did anything with, and we started Smalltalk from that. And then there was this whole kind of substructure of Smalltalk. I looked at that, but like I said, things like eval were still pretty deep voodoo, I think. And I think at this point, really, there was just an awareness of it, and a sense that, yeah, it could be changed if I understand it, but I don't really understand it yet.
Yeah, you know what I find ironic about all this is that they were introducing it at PARC Smalltalk to children and trying to teach them how to use it. And the idea behind this, at least at that time, was that Smalltalk was supposed to be easy enough for children to learn it. And then all through the 90s, at the point when I was, really starting to get into Smalltalk, the rap that we had in the industry was that the learning curve for Smalltalk was tremendous. And it's kind of interesting. I've always wondered how we got from point A to point B, where back in the 70s and into the early 80s, the idea was, this is so simple, the children can use it, to where we got to in the early 90s when people were saying, oh my gosh, this is very complicated, nobody can learn it.
Well, I mean, I think I can hazard a guess there. Early 90s, there really wasn't a language around that came with a kabillion classes and a big book of class libraries. I mean, that's commonplace for a language these days. But not back then. I mean, you got the language and it was empty and it allowed you to create and design concepts yourself. But Smalltalk came along and it wasn't empty and it came with all of this stuff. It even told you how to do geometry. Here is a circle. So I know what a circle is. You don't have to tell me what a circle is. But now you want me to learn all of these tokens that go with circles to be able to do circles in Smalltalk. So, I mean, that's pretty big when you think about it and clearly the right direction. But for someone who comes from a programming language where even Pi doesn't exist, right? I mean, you look at how many COBOL programs define Pi themselves.
Yeah, it's possible that transition also started fairly early in the life of Smalltalk itself, because this four-year experiment with kids ended in the middle of 1977, before Smalltalk 76 was actually finished. The number 76 was the year that it was conceived, not the year that it was actually delivered. So no kids ever programmed in Smalltalk 76, which was really the first modern Smalltalk. The whole experience of working with kids was with this first early version of Smalltalk. And the language changed in a number of ways, and the emphasis of the group changed as well. After this period, really, the emphasis was shifting towards trying to get the technology itself out into the world. That's what Smalltalk 80 was all about. So I don't know. It seems, I have a similar question about that to what Jim just raised. How this emphasis shifted? Why it wasn't carried over?
The sophistication of what the Smalltalk machines were doing post 76. Was pretty profound, right? I mean, we're talking about a system that had networking, real-time video, WYSIWYG text editing, object sharing across the network. That underneath that's going to be a lot of code. And most of that stuff never made it into Smalltalk 80.
True. Yeah, that's true.
And that so that's pretty interesting. So they cut it down. And if people are saying it's hard to learn all this stuff and they cut it down, that's pretty fascinating all in itself. I'm curious, were you in the Smalltalk Kids videos? Which group was that?
I think they made those videos partly to study the pedagogy, and that was done with the earliest group. So I was not in any of those, and I don't remember them making any videos during the time that I was there. I think those videos date from the first 2 years, 74, 75, and maybe they made some at the Jordan Middle School as well. I haven't seen those, by the way.
No, I was just Googling for them a little while ago when somebody in the IRC channel raised the idea of whether you would appear in any of them. I couldn't even find a reference. You know, I could find maybe a couple of references, but I couldn't find any links to that video. I did find a rather funny video of Alan Kay making fun of Edgar Dijkstra, but that was as close as I got to it, actually.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it, and I don't know where I got it from, but I'm pretty sure I got it off the net somewhere.
Okay.
And there was a little kid, and he had written a program that drew a circle. And I thought that was really impressive because when I was his age, I don't think I knew how to make a circle. So,
I could add also that Dan Ingalls, on a more contemporary note, recently created a Smalltalk 72 emulator that runs inside Squeak, and it's available on the Squeak repository. And from the screenshots, it looks pretty much like the original. So if you're curious about the first Smalltalk, you can load it up.
So you could get a copy of Squeak and then load up Dan Ingalls' 72 simulator and get kind of a reasonable analog for what you guys were looking at back then.
Yeah.
Huh, that'd be interesting.
And the prompt is this funny little character, which is actually an icon for the terminal of the Alto with its portrait display and a little keyboard nestled in front. So if you find it and you're wondering what the heck that thing is, it's the interim Dynabook prompt.
Did you know what the Dynabook was meant to be from your time there?
No, I had no idea. No, nobody ever said this is it. It wasn't sitting in a glass box in the lobby, or you know, the Kay's cardboard model. There was nothing like that. I had no idea until years later.
I think there was a great story. I think it was Dan Ingalls talking about taking the Dynabook on an airplane trip, the first Dynabook with, and he had to use two seats, one for the computer and batteries, and the other one for him. So it was an expensive flight all around. But he discovered on the flight that there was no room to move the mouse. So he inverted the mouse controls because the classes and the codes was just there, turned the mouse upside down and used the little trackball as a trackball, you know, so it was the first the first trackpad basically. And that was his innovative solution for not having any room on the plane.
So innovation caused by airline stodginess. Awesome. All right. Well, I guess, I don't know, I think that pretty much covers what we wanted to cover, I think, unless you had anything you wanted to add to wrap up, Mark?
No.
Okay. Well, in that case, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating. I didn't really know much of anything about this this whole epic.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. I find that when I'm refactoring, I tend to focus on little things. This method is too long. This variable should be pushed to the superclass. This class should be renamed. This code is duplicated. It's surprising how important these little things are. In fact, I find that good design tends to come out of a focus on the small details. Each of them may seem insignificant, but when put together, they make a significant difference to the whole. Software design is all about details. If you can express those details better or make them easier to change, you have a net win. It's when you stop worrying about the little details that the design starts to fall apart. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Hireen Thacker, our contributor in India, reports that in Bangalore, Honeywell has a position for their HPS Configurator Tools development team for a senior engineer who has experience in Cybele and Smalltalk. More specifically, they are looking for someone with a university degree in engineering, parenthetically electronics or instrumentation or computer science, around 2 to 3 years of experience in a similar industry, and experience with OOPS concepts. Experience that is considered a plus includes industrial automation domains or distributed control systems. Hong Kong. J.P. Morgan Chase has a permanent position for an IB Technology Asia Capital Operation Analyst who has excellent communication skills, financial derivatives interest or experience, a mathematics background, and OO programming experience. It is considered a plus if the person knows Smalltalk, has an understanding of the rates, credits, hybrids, flow business, or an understanding of P&L risk management. Austin, Texas, USA. IBM has a permanent position for a Level 3 service specialist who has experience with C, shell scripts, Java, and Smalltalk. Minneapolis, Minnesota. A large number of companies, including Unison Systems, Inc. and Precision System Design, are looking to fill a 6-month contract for a Smalltalk systems developer who also has experience with Envy, GUI experience, Unix, Microsoft Windows, XML, Oracle, PLSQL, SQL stored procedures, inventory, and data networking. It is considered a plus if the developer has experience with VisualWorks and Java. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of these Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.